This Week in Palestine offers news from a Palestinian perspective. The following hour may contain views that do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be. This is Bethany Marks, and I welcome you back to another episode of This Week in Palestine. As always, we turn our attention to Gaza and the West Bank, because while the world watches, the suffering persists. The headlines change, but the reality on the ground remains. Today is Sunday, June 1st, 2025, and we continue to ask, what will it take to turn global outrage into meaningful action? Stay with us as we dive deeper into the unfolding events. I want to take a moment to share an important call to action. Stop starving Gaza. Join us this Tuesday, June 3rd at 5:30 p.m. for a standout at Park Street Tea Station, Boston. Wear black and bring an empty pot as a symbol of solidarity. Additionally, another standout to stop the killing takes place every Tuesday from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. at the Zionist Consulate, 20 Park Plaza, Boston. Your presence matters. Raise your voice. Stand for justice. You are listening to This Week in Palestine. Truth and Justice Radio. Today, I bring to you an important discussion from Status Corps, hosted by the insightful Zainab Day, featuring none other than the sharp and courageous journalist Appy Martin. This discussion is more than just a conversation. It's a crucial reflection on the situation unfolding in Gaza, and the disturbing reality of how our current administration is framing this crisis as the new normal. Why am I bringing you this discussion? Because it lays bare the troubling dynamics behind American loyalty being subtly and forcefully redirected not toward the United States, but toward Israel. While over 60% of Americans struggle to make ends meet, living at or below the poverty level, our hard-earned tax dollars are financing Israel's military operations, contributing to what many international bodies and human rights advocates describe as genocide. This raises a fundamental question. How did we get here? How did a nation built on the ideals of freedom of speech and democracy arrive at a point where merely saying Free Palestine is being criminalized in many states? When dissent becomes a punishable act, when advocating for human rights is framed as extremism, we are forced to confront uncomfortable truths about the erosion of democratic principles. In this discussion, Zainab Day and Appy Martin unravel the layers of misinformation, political maneuvering, and media control that have shaped public perception. They examine how mainstream narratives seek to suppress opposition while conditioning Americans to accept the unquestioned funneling of resources into foreign conflicts, even as millions here at home grapple with economic hardship. But this is more than just analysis. It's a call to action. It urges us to think critically, to question authority, and to reclaim the right to open discourse. Because without these freedoms, without the ability to stand up and speak out against injustice, what remains of the democracy we were promised? This discussion is not just timely, it is necessary. It pushes us to rethink allegiance, to redefine patriotism, and to demand accountability from those in power. The silence is deafening, but the voices of resistance grow louder. The question remains, will we listen? Let's listen to their discussion.
You know, when hundreds of people are being killed in single airstrikes every day, I look back at the Great March of Return, where 200 plus Palestinians were killed in that amount of time. And to see that many people getting killed every day, that normalization of that rampant slaughter is something that I don't want. I don't want us to normalize this, and I don't want us to ever feel your callous disregard for mass slaughter of kids.
And hey, it's Jordan. I am in Flint, Michigan, East Palestine, Ohio,
Tumwa, Iowa.
Please support the only independent outlet on the ground covering what the corporate media covers up.
Hey guys, welcome to this edition of Status Coup News, and we're so excited. We are speaking to Abby Martin today, and she is a journalist that's well known for her documentary filmmaking and her projects with Empire Files. Her amazing documentary, Gaza Fights for Freedom, is one of the most informative I have ever watched on the issues in Gaza and Palestine. She was on the ground for the March of Return in 2018, and the documentary is, if you haven't seen it, watch it. You need to. So we're very excited to have Abby on today. We're going to be talking about anti-boycott, divest, and sanction laws, what those are, and just generally what's been going on with the suppression of freedom of speech, the issues that we have arising today that kind of brings everything into focus, and how this isn't exactly new. So Abby, welcome. And I'd love to start off, if you want to tell us just a little bit about kind of your journey with Gaza Fights for Freedom, to, you know, your coverage that kind of led you into, I know you, one of the things we're going to talk about today is your embroiled battle with Georgia regarding anti-BDS laws there that were in place long before October 7th, long before the latest genocide in Gaza was taking place.
Indeed. And thank you for having me, Zainab. You know, let's just go back to, you know, my awakening really quickly. I mean, getting back to the Gaza Flotilla raid in 2010, when I saw this horrific mass slaughter of unarmed peace activists on a boat bringing aid to Gaza, and the way that the media distorted the coverage was just frankly startling to me and set me on the path of just completely unadulterated, unabashed pro-Palestine liberation view. And so my journalism ever since has been really unapologetically pro-Palestinian from that kind of lens. It was, you know, kind of living through a couple of the mowing the lawn operations where they just go and do this mass killing every couple of years in Gaza. And then the March of Return started. And it was something that had never happened before in Gaza, which was a completely peaceful, you know, thousands and thousands of people going to this fortified artificial border fence that really just separates them from their ancestral lands that they can see with their own eyes, and just holding flags, burying their chests and doing chants. And they were met with the same kind of egregious violence that we see no matter what Palestinians do, whether or not they resist violently or nonviolently, which is that they were mowed down by snipers that were cowardly perched up behind sand dunes and just mowing down people who were hundreds of yards away from the fence, doing absolutely nothing at all. Disabled people in wheelchairs, little children, you know, medics and journalists. And I think at that point, Zainab, the most shocking thing to me was just the flagrant violation of international law, the egregious nature of the mass murder, with all the world watching. And documenting these war crimes, and then realizing, oh my God, like no one even moved a muscle. Everyone kind of just justified this in retrospect. I remember the front cover of, I think it was the Times of Israel, just said, "Israelis reflect. I hope every bullet was justified." The day after 60 people were mowed down in one of the most horrific, you know, massacres in modern history. So I think taking a snapshot in time and fast forwarding it to today, and seeing the utter devastation and carnage, where at this point, I don't even think genocide and ethnic cleansing do it justice. What we have been witnessing, we've been witnessing a mass murder and torture box where 2 million people are trapped and we just also have to watch them being starved to death and murdered. And so, you know, when hundreds of people are being killed in single airstrikes every day, I look back at the Great March of Return, where 200 plus Palestinians were killed in that amount of time. And to see that many people getting killed every day, that normalization of that rampant slaughter is something that I don't want. I don't want us to normalize this, and I don't want us to ever feel callous disregard for mass slaughter of kids. And so, you know, at that point, I think when we made the movie, we thought this was one of the most heinous, horrific things that Israel has ever done. And if people just knew, certainly the world would move. But I think we all know now that there's something collectively, we're watching the specter of the collective, of our collective humanity that has died. And I don't know how else to explain it, but when I see what's going on in Gaza today, there's no words saying that. There really is not. And it's still happening.
We knew the moment that they stated, Israel stated, we are blockading water, food, and we are giving 24-hour notice to move people from northern Gaza to Rafah, that this was devastating. That was on October 10th. That moment was devastating. Now we're 19 months in with massive catastrophe. Less than 2 million people now being starved. We had a very brief ceasefire, which wasn't a ceasefire at all because nothing really stopped. People were able to move slightly. And then the bombing started again where people were fleeing to. So people moved into Rafah, and what was it, a week later, they started bombing Rafah again. So what are your thoughts on kind of, without going too deep into it, on what are your feelings overall about Congress and, yeah, I know you and I have.
I love them. They're doing a great job.
On Congress and the current administration, their efforts, they're still huge dehumanizing tactics and their refusal to even move on this issue.
It's been that horrific conundrum that has been a gun pointed to the heads of the left for my entire adult life, Zainab, which is you have to vote for the lesser of two evils to prevent your reproductive rights from being taken away, to prevent full-fledged fascism from coming, to prevent the deconstruction of our sacred democracy. And I think that this election really laid bare just how just hollow all of these threats are. I mean, the fact that our abortion rights were rescinded during a Democratic administration, and just in general for 2 years almost, the left and a lot of people who have a conscience in this country have been protesting relentlessly against this genocide under a liberal administration that we know now did nothing to pressure Netanyahu's cabinet. Nothing. Not once did they ever go and say ceasefire now. Not once. So it was clear that Trump, probably just for PR reasons for his inauguration, wanted that temporary cessation and massacres. You know, he exerted some sort of leverage because we know that Israel is America's colonial outpost. They're its military garrison in the Middle East to tamp down on independence movements, to you know, basically just protect the fossil fuel infrastructure and to prevent any of America's so-called enemies from getting more power. But so it's just absurd. It's absurd to see what we've been witnessing, Zainab, and it's absurd to see that, you know, Trump doesn't care at all. I mean, he's a completely hollow, empty suit for whatever business interests and whatever he can get in return. And so, you know, Netanyahu's extremely close with him. Jared Kushner personally profits off of the settlement process in the West Bank. We saw that horrific hallucinatory AI video that Trump put out on social media showing his golden head on a balloon, showing Trump, you know, taking over Gaza, essentially, with Elon Musk and Netanyahu celebrating, drinking martinis on the beach. It's very surreal. It's a very surreal moment when you have the mask completely removed, where the current administrator of the U.S. empire is just plainly stating, we are going to ethnically cleanse Gaza. Like, this is happening. We're just going to retake it over. What's the big deal? These people are starving. Hey, what? They don't want to come back and just get shot and killed, right? I mean, this is the kind of the state that we're living in, is that reality is almost just too weird to parse through. It's like, how do we decipher this kind of black and like this upside down reality that they're telling us, you know, from the top, when we see the truth with our own eyes? We can turn on the phone, see the reality of the Holocaust, see the fact that I just saw a poll, Zainab, that 60% of Americans are poor. The middle class is non-existent. 60% of Americans they don't have a standard of life, let alone a savings. I mean, this is the country that we're living in. So of course Trump won. Of course he did, because the status quo can't hold. The status quo is death. So yeah. Kamala Harris and her cohorts already, the dysfunctionality and the detachment of just everyday life in this country, when you couple that to feeding a genocide that's just mass slaughtering kids, and when you have Biden telling Americans we have to sacrifice at the gas pump to fight Putin, none of that resonates. And so, of course, Trump wins. Trump's the only one talking about legacy media, fake news. Trump's the only one talking about, I mean, love or hate J.D. Vance. I think a lot of your viewers probably hate him, and a good reason, but they were the only ones talking about poor people in Appalachia.
Yeah.
He's the only one acknowledging the fact that there's poor people in this country. So, of course, faux populism and all of these things, they're going to capitalize on the disenfranchised. They're going to capitalize on the people who are truly suffering, and they're going to fold them all into right-wing politics, because you and I both know that left-wing politics, an actual critique on power, which is the capitalist system, is the only thing that really is the threat to power. And so the left is going to be sidelined and blamed every time. And all of that energy is going to continue to be sucked in and siphoned into the right wing. And it's really unfortunate to see, because I think the majority of people buy into the rhetoric. They want the anti-establishmentism. They want populism. They want to fight the oligarchy. They don't want necessarily to punch down and blame immigrants and trans people, but it's easier, isn't it? It's easier.
And when the Democrats have opened the door to the massive dehumanization that we saw with the treatment of Palestine in Gaza, I said, they're opening the doorway right now to Trump. Stephen Miller is no different than Matthew Miller.
Yes.
We're looking at parallels. Yes. This is opening the door for when Trump wins, because I knew he was going to win. It's going to normalize this dehumanization, and we're going to see it here on our own population. It shouldn't take us that to care, but that's also a part of it. That's also a fact that it is coming home to roost. We are seeing, you know, and we've seen it before. You and I both covered that the terrible immigration policies under the Obama administration, under the Biden administration. So we've had some of these abhorrent policies before, but they normalized the Trump administration going after universities now to deport all these students without due process. Mm-hmm. They've normalized jackboot thugs on the street in civilian clothes, rounding up people in unmarked cars with their faces covered. The Biden administration normalized this when they were willing to overlook mass atrocities and war crimes being carried out by Israel.
100%. I mean, remember the Obama former advisor, the national security official, that was caught at the food cart in New York City just saying, "That's not enough dead Palestinian kids. I want more." And he said it knowing he was being filmed, because that's who these people are. The difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, you just lift the mask off, Zainab. It's the same ideology. It's just about decorum. It's about Trump being uncouth and too belligerent. None of them care about Palestinian kids. None of them humanize Palestinian lives. And that is crystallized. That is so clear as day. And it is sick. I mean, what I've come to terms with is I have to realize that my entire life's career has been, if I just could tell people the truth, if I could just educate people, people would care. People would mobilize themselves. People would act. I have to come to terms with the fact that a lot of people not only don't care, but revel in the suffering of others. A lot of people are fascist and actually don't care if children die. Beyond that, they want anyone who's not them to be killed. So it's been a learning, I think, moment for a lot of us, Zainab, in the last 2 years of the collective failure of just humanity at large, but also just what we have to come to terms with about who we live amongst.
Yeah, and you wake up every day and you say, oh, I'm only half human. To these people, we're only half human. And then you had arguments during the election that were abhorrent. People minimizing Democrats, people that were supporting Kamala Harris, minimizing this, you know, pundits and others saying, "Well, Trump's going to level Gaza."
Oh God!
As if it hadn't already been leveled, or if one life is saved by voting in Kamala, that's better than one life that is lost voting in Trump, even if we lose 150,000 lives, if one life is saved. It's like, what are you, where is your metric?
Yeah, what calculation are you guys? It's like Palestinian lives are non-negotiable to me. I'm sorry. Like, I agree that Trump is very scary domestically. He's a fascist. He ran on a fascist platform, but I, in good conscience, cannot vote for genocide of my brothers and sisters. Do you understand that? And how dare you tell Palestinians and lecture to them that they should have? That's sick.
The bar's in hell. The bar was in hell. And so why is it so shocking now that we have rampant fascism? That we've this just fully gone in the direction of rampant fascism.
Exactly, Zaina. When you normalize this kind of behavior, especially abroad, this is the U.S. empire is a global fascist military dictatorship, actually, and tens of millions of people are living under its boot and suffering every day. And the people who are conscious of that and have international solidarity and have a lens that's a perspective to see outside of our country already knew that. And so we saw the writing on the wall. We knew that the status quo couldn't hold. We knew that the Democratic Party was the inevitability would pave the way for Trump. And now here we are. We're in Trumpism. We're living the authoritarian nightmare that we all knew was coming. And to your point, I mean, Palestinians are the first, but they're not the last. This is a warning shot, and it's a testing ground. For all the surveillance technology, all the Silicon Valley overlords who now curate our reality, all of this is coming home to roost.
Well, Palantir, we'll get into the, close out with the anti-BDS laws, but Palantir just secured and is pitching government contracts to control Alex Karp, and you have Peter Thiel. They're wanting to control it for different reasons, but to control and basically utilize AI to replace the labor force across every single government agency. So they are going to have access to your tax documents, to your, to any Medicare, Medicaid. We're talking about every USDA, NOAA. I mean, they could lie to us about the weather if they want to, and that's the truth. And part of the reason, and not to mention that, of course, they have massive spending within the Defense Department, which we saw some of that utilized in Gaza in a horrific way when we saw Lavender be implemented, which was an AI that was targeting individuals, Daddy's Home, that specifically targeted anyone, any male under 30, and it would target them at their house with their family, because that's where they could target them the easiest. And then they would just blow up an entire apartment building under the guise of, oh, we're using AI to target people. We're being selective. But it's a dystopian nightmare. And Palantir recently in New Orleans, it's Minority Report shit. They were utilizing AI to determine basically pre-crime there and potential targets for individuals that may commit crime in the future. Like, what is this? Yeah, but that is what's coming home. And they tested this in the West Bank and in Gaza. They tested it in the West Bank on scanning individual social media, on scanning for people to arrest there for anyone who had any kind of dissenting views. And I would love to hear some of your thoughts on that.
Oh my God. I mean, there's so much to say. I mean, first of all, the fact that Trump's second term has really folded in all of the Silicon Valley tech oligarchs who kind of virtue signaled during the first term that they were all up in arms about, you know, Trump's policies and what Trump was standing for. All the pretense is lifted. They are all in. Okay. When we look at something like Palantir and Peter Thiel and the PayPal mafia, I mean, just look at what Palantir has been doing in Gaza. You mentioned the Lavender program, the Daddy's Home, where they recognized with the AI system that has God knows how much of a failure rate. I mean, just look at the AI implementation in the United Healthcare, doling out claims and denial of claims, 90% error rate. That's the going error rate with some of these AI programs. So just imagine that, put that in your back pocket when you're thinking of they are using a callous robotic system to determine who to kill And not only who to kill alongside their families and whoever's in the proximity of a phone. So that's what they're doing. And so this kind of plausible deniability of, oh, well, Hamas uses human shields, and oh, well, they're just, it's really densely populated, and oh, well, they were just around a Hamas target. All of these are complete violations of international law. They are total war crimes. You cannot do that. Like, it is so far beyond the pale of anything in the Geneva Conventions that you can use an AI model to just mass target 30,000 supposed Hamas fighter, low-level fighters. And I mean, let's just remind people that that Hamas was the governing body. It was the government.
Exactly. So this is these are people that are working at the DMV, literally.
Water, like working on the water infrastructure, the electricity. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sick. It's sick. That poor son of the agricultural minister who did that, who the BBC put a target on his back because he just happened to tell a story about surviving a genocide, but he happened to be linked to a Hamas civilian person. And so now a target's on that poor kid's back. I mean, it's just sick. The AI, the AI takeover of society. Look, I'm not necessarily anti-AI. I think that AI lifting our personal labor is a good thing. The problem is there's no incremental like measurement of how we can like get people out of the jobs that AI is going to take over and put them into other jobs. There's no government jobs programs. There's nothing. It's going to be a rug pull over the next several years where you have Trump and all of his speeches that no one's really reporting on, Zainab, about how he's saying he's going to double the electricity grid in the US just to pay for AI. And when you mention the imperial boomerang and these policies coming home to roost, absolutely. You see Palantir hand in glove working with the Trump administration. They just got a $30 million contract to work with ICE. They are the bedrock and the grid of all of the ICE draconian surveillance technology at the border and beyond. So all of the people that they're rounding up and deporting, Palantir is providing the data. I mean, this is the new world that we're in. I mean, when you hear Alex Karp being disrupted by a Palestinian saying, your tech is killing my people, his reaction was surreal. Zainab, I mean, his reaction is surreal. These people are maniacal, they're genocidal maniacs, and they are pure sociopaths. I mean, Peter Thiel almost seems more human than this new guy. He's basically
Karp is scary.
I mean, he's nuts. He's saying heads need to roll, people need to die, as long as you're on the good side and not the evil side. It's just, I mean, it is cartoonishly, maniacally insane. Like, this guy is just a nightmare. But look, it's all coming home to roost and it's all integrated. And Gaza's been a testing ground for a long time, Zainab. And you have these weapons tech defense contractors using Gaza as the example, where they go around and parade around their technology around the world and say, look how well it works.
Yeah. Exactly. I'm doing a deep dive on this, and I've been about 4 months now. I started a project with Lila Charles and Pat Cody from Punch Up Pod, and we're doing a 12-part series on the Broligarchy. And and what we've discovered every day is something more horrifying. That we were pretty informed on this issue before, but had no idea how crazy it was. I mean, you have Balaji Sarvesen, who wrote The Network State, saying that it's going to be techno-Zionism. So basically arguing that they're going to roll out the model openly saying we're going to roll out the model that Israel is using against Palestinians nationwide in the United States. You have, like you were saying, Karp from Palantir he literally brags about targeting and killing people as the selling point for Palantir. And that kind of ties into the anti-BDS laws because, I mean, you and I didn't sue, but I have been covering Palestine. I supported anti-BDS. I was part of the BDS movement when I was in college. I covered what was happening in Palestine and Gaza as a college student, mm-hmm. as a college journalist. And then after I got out of college, I still continued to cover it. And I remember applying for jobs in Kentucky in nonprofits and orgs and continually being denied because of the anti-BDS laws that we had in Kentucky. I was having trouble getting jobs. It's not about me. This is about a broader problem. Now, when AI is going to be involved, now scrubbing for people who support Palestine, people who stood up against mass atrocities and war crimes, now specifically targeting them, it's going to get worse than even what happened to the NYU student who just had their, you know, diploma stripped because they dared to mention the atrocities that are going on in Gaza in a speech he made on graduation day, just yesterday, I believe it was. So tell me about what kind of happened with you in Georgia. And I know we have to wrap up pretty soon, but what happened there and kind of how does that tie into the bigger picture of legislation that I know we've had legislation that just got tabled. This legislation is being pushed, if not nationally, it will be pushed nationally, but it's still being pushed through the states. So what happened in Georgia?
Okay, so in Georgia, just like 26 other states in the country and potentially more, it's kind of ambiguous how many have passed these laws, have passed anti-boycott, divestment, and sanctions laws. So to your point, and what happened to me was that, you know, if you're an independent contractor, if you're applying for a state organization or to work in a, under a state contract, you are given paperwork that says you have to contractually oblige, basically pledge fealty to a foreign country and to forfeit our First Amendment rights, which is not only the right to free speech, which is the sacred bedrock of our American democracy, but also the right to boycott. This is a right that was enshrined by the Supreme Court back during the Montgomery bus boycotts during the civil rights movement. So the fact that this is already preemptively passed years before October 7th is just a sign to me that the Israel lobby knew the writing on the wall. They knew the tide of justice that was inevitably coming to try to make apartheid fall and to stop the genocide that has been a long campaign and to start on October 7th. And so they tried to pass these laws under the guise of anti-Semitism, and they've tricked a lot of state legislatures to do so. And what they do is just completely stymie our ability to do, to practice our fundamental constitutional First Amendment rights, Zainab. And it creates this chilling effect across the board, where especially in the light of this crackdown on college campuses, people are just simply terrified to speak out on social media, in their workplaces, wear any sort of symbol of Palestinian solidarity. It is truly existential to a lot of people that they could lose their jobs and have their careers destroyed if they simply speak out against a genocide. And what that does, I think, point to the broader legislation that's been happening. What happened in my case? Sorry, to wrap up my story. What happened in my case is I sued the state of Georgia because I was given this contract. Long story short is I won in the interim because, of course, the principle of free speech stands, and any constitutional lawyer and judge would see the clear violations that these laws pose. The problem is that an Israeli consulate official came to the Georgia state legislature throughout that year and lobbied them to change and amend the law to actually render my case moot. So it's a super bizarre legal thing that they did in my case, that the law technically is struck, like with the principle, but it's technically still on the books because they changed it. So the cap is now 100,000 versus 1,000. So now someone has to come in that's making $100,000 under the state of Georgia and still sue, and then the law will be struck. So it's like, I still won in principle. You can't put a price tag. It doesn't mean it matter if you're making a penny, a dollar, $100, $1,000, or $1,000,000. The law still applies. But because they did this trickery with the language, it's still technically on the book. So they could still say that they won and that I lost, but really I did win still, and the principle still stands, and the law still will be struck down. But it requires someone like a Ben and Jerry's, like a Roger Waters, someone to go in there that can make that much money and finally strike it down. But I think what's so dangerous is you look at the scale and scope of anti-BDS legislation, the conflation of, you know, anti-Semitism with Judaism and all of, or, I'm sorry, with criticism of Israel and anti-Semitism. The laws that are being proposed now are so wide-reaching and so draconian and dangerous. You mentioned the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. Luckily, this was just tabled in the Senate. It passed the House. It was tabled in the Senate after this kind of fiery hearing from a lot of people who said, look, do you want Europe's laws or not? Because that's what this is. This is a slippery slope that will basically change the working definition of anti-Semitism to these disingenuous front groups, the Holocaust Remembrance Act, Anti-Defamation League, all of these disingenuous front groups that are, by extension, basically pro-Israel lobbying groups that have completely just destroyed the definition of anti-Semitism to encompass criticisms of apartheid and genocide. Apartheid, right. A Jim Crow style government. We can't criticize that. Otherwise, we're anti-Semitic. And it's this conflation that is so dangerous that actually exacerbates anti-Semitism, that actually threatens Jewish people around the world because Israel doesn't represent Jews. So now, at the most important place to have free speech, the bedrock of what should be the shining example of constitutional liberties, college campuses, where so many resistance movements have burgeoned and flourished, that is where it is being censored and stymied intentionally, because they know they have to crack down and tamp down on what is happening on college campuses. And so teachers, students, college administrators, they are going to be terrified if this bill passes. They already are terrified. You see them kowtowing to fascists saying, please don't take my university funding. I'll do whatever you want. Here's all our students. Round them up, ICE. You can't kowtow to fascists. You just can't. So these college administrators, they have to stand up and say no more, and they have to protect their students. And I don't see that happening enough. And so
Harvard stood up for like 10 seconds and then backpedaled.
Exactly. This bill is it's such a dangerous slippery slope. And you know, they want to turn this country into Europe. They want to eliminate free speech for everyone except them. They've used free speech as this rallying cry for the fascists and the MAGA cultists for so long. And then the second they get power, we realize what the real play is. That it's free speech for me, not for thee. And in fact, we will deport you. We will terrorize you. We will kill you if we don't like your speech. And so that's the reality that we're wading into, Zainab?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, Hassan Abi, Hassan Piker, YouTube or Twitch streamer, was stopped at the airport this week and interrogated. That sends a chilling effect. That sends a chilling effect on, and anyone that remembers the no-fly list. I was on the no-fly list. I was denied a passport. I was born here in London, Kentucky. My dad's an Iranian immigrant. But I was denied a passport. I was on the no-fly list. So these types of cutting away of our rights have been going on for so long that it starts to normalize it. The anti-BDS laws started, under Obama? Absolutely. In 2014 were the first laws, in 2012, 2014.
And I know that we have to wrap up, but I just wanted to finish with this, is that I truly think this is an entry point to synonymize any critique of American empire. It's not just about Israel. This is the entry point. This is the easiest way to get us there. They want to eventually make it illegal, basically, to criticize or dissent against American imperialism. And Gaza is simply the opening. I think the explosion of mass consciousness, the linking of international solidarity, people are connecting, you know, the connective tissue with all of these struggles under this global system. And so Gaza is the easiest way to synonymize support for Palestinians with terrorism. And the anti-Semitism cover has been ingenious, and it's worked. And this is, we have to wake up, because this is not stopping and starting with Palestine. It's coming for us all, Zainab.
Yep. And people are starving right now. Children are. Yes. Can you let us know where we can find you? And we really appreciate you coming on and speaking with us today about such important bullshit that is happening across the globe and here in the US. But if you could let folks know where to find you, if there's any projects you have coming up or anything. Absolutely. You'd like to talk about.
Yes, and thank you. I love Status Quo and I love what you guys are doing anytime. Please check out Gaza Fights for Freedom. It's a free movie online, and it really is a really important film. I think anyone who's on the fence, I don't know how you can be at this point, but it really changes minds. In terms of what we're working on now, we're working on a film called Earth's Greatest Enemy. It's coming out this summer. We're doing a huge nationwide tour. It's about the U.S. military's impact on the environment. It's a one-stop shop in totality of the entire beast, the gargantuan topic of how the U.S. military is destroying the planet. And I'm super excited for it to hopefully be a tool that can be used and interjected in the mainstream environmental movement to bring the issue of militarism to the forefront. Otherwise, we're truly doomed. Thank you so much. And I hope people check it out, earthsgreatestenemy.com. Thank you.
I can't wait to see that. Thank you so much, Abby. Have a great day.
Thank you so much. Free Gaza, free Palestine.
You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio. Today, we gather not just to bear witness, but to stand against injustice. As the world watches, Israel continues its relentless assault on Gaza and the West Bank, turning homes to rubble, schools to graveyards, and hospitals to battlegrounds. The war rages on, indiscriminate in its destruction, while millions of innocent Palestinians face a reality that no human being should endure. The pattern is tragically familiar: an airstrike here, a military raid there. Each time, Israel claims self-defense, while the world repeats the same empty rhetoric. But the evidence is undeniable. Civilians are not collateral damage. They are the targets. Entire families are wiped out in a single strike. Journalists documenting the horror are hunted down. Medical personnel working to save lives are killed alongside their patients. The destruction is systematic, intentional, and absolute. And yet, Israel is determined to erase its crimes, rewriting history while silencing those who dare to speak. Their leaders dismiss massacres as necessary. Their media deflects blame. Their allies shield them from accountability. They censor, suppress, and distort, fabricating justifications to mask the sheer scale of human suffering. For decades, Western governments and European leaders have blindly echoed these lies, refusing to challenge Israel's actions while pouring billions into its military. They have framed Palestinians as aggressors, labeled resistance as terrorism, and justified occupation under the guise of security. But now, when the genocide unfolding before our eyes is too horrifying to ignore, they are scrambling to shift the blame. Suddenly, they whisper about Israel's crimes, offering weak condemnations, pretending they had no idea what was happening. But it is too late. The years of complicity cannot be undone with words. No amount of regret will bring back the murdered children. No diplomatic shift will erase the suffering of millions. The bodies of Palestinians stack higher than their apologies, and the world must finally recognize that silence equals complicity. Yet, the cost of standing for Palestine has never been higher. Across the United States, people who demand justice are being arrested, threatened, and vilified. Protesters are beaten, activists are jailed, voices are silenced. In state after state, merely saying Free Palestine has become a crime. Universities are punishing students for expressing solidarity, silencing graduation speeches, expelling those who refuse to conform. But despite the fear, students have chosen courage over compliance. This year, graduates across the country refused to walk the stage, choosing instead to make their moment count to speak for the dead, to fight for the living. Their stand reminds us that justice is not granted, it must be demanded. But nothing encapsulates the cruelty of this war more than the stories of those who died trying to save lives. We all remember what happened on March 23, 2025. 15 paramedics from the Palestine Red Crescent Society and Gaza Civil Defense rushed to rescue civilians caught in yet another Israeli attack. They never returned. Israeli forces executed them one by one, their bodies later found buried in a shallow grave alongside their crushed ambulances. These were first responders, medics who had spent their lives saving others, only to be hunted down and murdered for doing their jobs. And how can we forget Hendra Jab, the 6-year-old Palestinian girl who begged for help as she lay trapped in her family's car, surrounded by the bodies of her loved ones? She called emergency responders, her voice trembling, pleading for someone to save her. Gunfire echoed in the background, and then silence. When rescuers finally reached her, they found her lifeless body alongside the paramedics who had tried to save her. The ambulance sent to rescue Hend was deliberately destroyed by Israeli tanks. And then, there is Dr. Alaya Al-Najjar, a woman who embodied hope in a place drowning in despair. A pediatrician in Gaza, she spent months tending to the wounded, stitching torn flesh, soothing terrified children, offering comfort where none could be found. She held their fragile hands, whispered promises that tomorrow would be better. But then, war found her home. 9 of her 10 children were killed in an Israeli airstrike that tore through her house. In an instant, the very war she had fought to heal stole everything she had left. Her husband and only surviving child remain in critical condition. Dr. Allah, the mother who had saved so many, was left to mourn her own. Her children, the same age as those she had fought for, became victims of the same bombs she had patched up. This is the cost of war. This is the price of silence. So I ask, you, will we let history remember us as bystanders to genocide? Or will we rise, speak, and demand the world to act? We cannot wait. We cannot hesitate. Palestine is bleeding. Free Palestine. End the occupation. Stop the killing. Before wrapping up for today, let's take a quick look at the history of Palestine. One of the central myths propagated by Zionist narratives is the claim that Palestine never existed as a country, a statement used to justify the displacement of Palestinians and the establishment of Israel. This argument is historically inaccurate and deliberately misleading. Let's look at the historical presence of Palestine. The name Palestine has been used for centuries, dating back to ancient times. The Romans renamed the region Syria Palestina in the 2nd century CE after suppressing Jewish revolt. The term continued to be used by various empires, including the Byzantines, Ottomans, and British, to describe the land inhabited by Palestinians, Jews, and other communities. Palestine's deep-rooted history stretches back thousands of years, encompassing rich civilizations, diverse cultures, and enduring resilience. As one of the world's most historically significant regions, its presence is woven into the fabric of ancient kingdoms, trade routes, and religious narratives. From the Canaanite era to the Ottoman rule, Palestine has been home to thriving societies with distinct languages, traditions, and governance. Its cities, such as Jerusalem, Hebron, Nablus, and Gaza, have stood as centers of commerce, scholarship, and spiritual significance. Throughout history, Palestine has witnessed conquests, migrations, and imperial influences, yet its people have remained steadfast, preserving their identity and cultural heritage. The 20th century brought intensified geopolitical struggles, leading to displacement and conflict, but Palestine's presence in historical records, literature, and global consciousness remains undeniable. Despite ongoing efforts to erase or redefine its identity, Palestine's historical presence is unshakable, rooted in its land, its people, and its enduring legacy. Now let's look at Zionist denial and manipulation. The tactics of denial and manipulation have long been employed to shape narratives surrounding Zionist policies and actions. By controlling the discourse, dismissing opposition, and redefining historical truths, these strategies work to reinforce a political agenda while silencing dissent. Denial manifests in several forms, Whether it's the erasure of Palestinian history, the rejection of internationally recognized human rights violations, or the dismissal of documented accounts of oppression. Even clear evidence, from UN reports to eyewitness testimonies, is frequently brushed aside as misinformation or bias. Manipulation, on the other hand, is wielded through media framing, political influence, and legal intimidation. Criticism of Israeli policies is often swiftly labeled as anti-Semitism, discouraging discourse and creating a false equivalence between legitimate political opposition and racial hatred. Laws criminalizing certain expressions, such as pro-Palestinian protests, or the phrase Free Palestine, further illustrate how political power shapes public perception. These methods extend beyond rhetoric. They directly impact policymaking, funding, and international responses. By shifting focus, blaming external forces, and suppressing historical context, Zionist narratives seek to maintain control while undermining justice. Acknowledging these strategies is key to challenging their impact and fostering honest discussions about history, accountability, and human rights. Finally, let's look at the modern recognition of Palestine. Despite Zionist efforts to erase Palestinian identity, Palestine is internationally recognized. Over 130 countries acknowledge Palestine as a state, and the United Nations grants it non-member observer status. The ongoing struggle for Palestinian liberation is rooted in the fact that Palestine was and remains a land with a people, a history, and a rightful claim to sovereignty. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio. Here are some of the most trending quotes. Netanyahu, quoted in Haaretz on May 19, "Our best friends in the world, senators I know as strong supporters of Israel, have warned that they cannot support us if images of mass starvation emerge," he said. "We must avoid famine, both for practical reasons and diplomatic ones. Without international backing, we won't be able to complete the mission of victory." Finance Minister Smotrich, "We are destroying everything that remains in Gaza. The world isn't stopping us." Zionist and Israeli activist Sophia Emuna, she said the quiet part out loud, "Destroy their offspring to prevent them from creating more offspring." Sir Edward Lee, the longest-serving member of the British Parliament's House of Commons, commented on Israel's actions in Gaza, asking, "When is genocide not genocide?" As we close out this episode, I want to remind you with the important call to action. Stop starving Gaza. Join us this Tuesday, June 3rd at 5:30 p.m. for a standout at Park Street T Station, Boston. Wear black and bring an empty pot as a symbol of resistance and solidarity. Additionally, the standout to stop the killing takes place every Tuesday from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. at the Zionist Consulate, 20 Park Plaza, Boston. Your voice matters. Your presence makes a difference. Stand for justice.
She stitched the wounds of crying children, held their hands through sleepless nights. But war came knocking at her doorstep, turned her love to scattered light. How do you heal when the cure is gone? How do you breathe when the air feels wrong? She called their names, but the silence spoke, and all that's left is ash and smoke. She called their names. She did call their names. She called their names, but silence spoke. And all that's left is ash and smoke. Tell me, where do the angels go when the skies burn red? How do the echoes fade when their laughter's
A mother's arms reach for ghosts in the dawn, but the night holds them close. Too far to start. Call their names. She did call their names. She called their names, but silence spoke. And all that's left is ash and smoke. Her hands once cradled fragile dreams. Now they tremble cold in bed. She gave the world her heart in pieces, but the world just didn't care. Through the rubble she still stands, a witness holding shattered hands. No justice, no reason, just endless cry. Yet still she refuses to close her eyes. Tell me, where do the angels go when the skies burn red? How do the echoes fade when their laughter's dead? A mother's arms reach for ghosts in the dark, but the night holds them close. Too far to stop. She called their names. She called their names. She called their names, but silence spoke. And all that's left is ash and smoke. The stars above bear their names tonight, whispered prayers in silver light. Dr. Allah stands, though torn apart, carrying Gaza's broken heart.
That wraps up today's episode. Stay informed, stay engaged, and never stop asking questions. Until next time, this is your host, Bethany Marks, and you've been listening to This Week in Palestine. If you have any questions or would like to support our work, feel free to reach out at twippodcasts@gmail.com. A heartfelt thank you to our incredible team working behind the scenes to make this show possible. Special appreciation goes to Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Stephen Lowe, Professor Ann Lucas, Sophia Rose Woolman, Lesh Tran, Tahani Abu Moza, Dr. Rana Awad, Juliet Salome Olivier, and Mohammed Al-Ghul. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, broadcasting from WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. As always, we deeply appreciate you spending your time with us today as we continue to fight for Palestinian liberation. See you next week.
Tell me, where do the angels go when the skies burn red? How do the echoes fade when their laughter's dead? A mother's arms reach for ghosts in the dark, but the night holds them close. Too far to stop. She called their names. She called their names. She called their names, but silence spoke. And all that's left, all that's left is ash and smoke. The stars above bear their names tonight, whispered prayers in silver light. Dr. Allah stands, though torn apart, carrying Gaza's broken heart.